It's Christmas once again, and in that spirit, we turn our attention to the late Mike Allen, that wonderful storyteller who for many years shared a Christmas reading of the best Christmas pageant ever. Mike never completed a reading, as that was an entire book, but nevertheless, he would read an excerpt for Ron Boone's Sunday School class and got out as much as his allotted time would allow. It's Christmas again, and once again, here's Mike.
Good morning. The public affairs program Heart of the Matter, which you're listening to, debuted almost exactly 3 years ago on this date on WRZI. Specifically, it was December 15th, 1996. The first program, ironically, was about the open heart program at Hardin Memorial Hospital with Dr. DeVries, Judge Dalton, Hank Wagner, and comments from others on that program. Today, the last Sunday before Christmas, we've asked our good friend Mike Allen to read us a Christmas story, which he shared with our Bible and Love Sunday School class a number of times over the years. It's about the Hardmans, the best Christmas pageant ever. Mike is an award-winning school teacher. He's a coach. His syndicated column runs in the Hardin County Independent, Corbin This Week, and other newspapers across the state. He's written several books, including Travelin' Light, which we reviewed in a news story about the same time in the year of 1995. Also, Fresh from Mount Salvage, I think, is one of his books. One of the hardest things to do is to read from the written page and make it come alive. I don't want to put pressure on Mike, but he does it about as well as anybody I've ever known. A great story reader. And the trick is to get this story into the allotted time. He'll have to edit himself as he goes along, and we'll flash some cue cards at him saying 4 minutes to go, Mike, or 3 minutes and so on. And we'll ease some appropriate Christmas music under him as well. Something we've never done on this program. We have a little bit of an audience for Mike here today. We have Heather and Kristen Barnes, Amy Symes, and Morgan Morehouse. Now, they're ages 5 to 8 along that category. So, Mike, take it away. Welcome.
Okay, thanks, Ron. First off, the book that we're reading today is The Best Christmas Pageant by Barbara Robinson. And for the most part, it's a touching story, it's a funny story, and to me it exemplifies the true meaning of Christmas. So with that said, I'm going to take off. The Hardmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied and stole and smoked cigars, even the girls. And they talked dirty and they hit little kids and cussed their teachers and took the name of the Lord in vain. And set fire to Fred Shoemaker's old broken-down tool house. Well, the tool house burned right down to the ground, and I think that surprised the Hardmans. They set fire to things all the time. But that was the first time they managed to burn down a whole building. I guess it's an accident. I don't suppose they woke up that morning and said to one another, "Hey, let's go burn down Fred Shoemaker's old tool house." But maybe they did. After all, it's a Saturday and not much was going on. They were just all around awful. You could hardly believe they were real. Ralph, Imogene, Leroy, Claude, Ollie, and Gladys. Six skinny, stringy-haired kids, all alike except for being different sizes and having different black and blue places where they clonked each other. They lived over a garage at the bottom of Sproul Hill. Nobody used a garage anymore, but the Hardmans used to bang the door up and down just as fast as they could and try to squash one another. That's their idea of a game. Where other people had grass in their front yard, the Hardmans had rocks. And where other people had hydrangea bushes, the Hardmans had poison ivy. There's also a sign in the yard that said, "Beware of the cat." New kids always laughed about that till they got a look at the cat. It was the meanest-looking animal I ever saw. It had one short leg and a broken tail and one missing eye, and the mailman wouldn't deliver anything to the Hardmans because of it. "I don't think it's a regular cat at all," the mailman told my father. "I think those kids went up in the hills and cut themselves a bobcat." "Oh, I don't think you can tame a wild bobcat," my father said. "I'm sure you can't," said the mailman. "They'd never try to tame it. They'd just try to make it wilder than it was to begin with." Well, if that's their plan, it worked. The cat would attack anything it could see out of its one good eye. One day, old Claude Hardman emptied the whole first grade in 3 minutes flat when he took the thing to show and tell. He didn't feed it for 2 days, so he was already mad. And then he carried it to school in a box. And when he opened that box, that cat shot out right straight up in there, people said. Came down on top of the blackboard ledge and clawed 4 big, long scratches all the way down the blackboard. Then it just tore around all over the place, scratching little kids and shedding fur and scattering books and papers everywhere. Teacher, Miss Brandell, yelled for everybody to run down the hall. And she pulled a coat up over her head and grabbed a broom and tried to corner the cat. But, of course, she couldn't see with the coat over her head, so she just ran up and down the aisles hollering, "Here, kitty, kitty," and smacking the broom down wherever the cat hits back. She knocked over the Happy Family dollhouse and a globe of the world and broke the aquarium full of 20 gallons of water and about 65 goldfish. All the time, she kept yelling for Claude to come and catch his cat, but Claude had gone out in the hall with the rest of the class. Later, when Miss Brandell was slapping Band-Aids on anybody that could show her any blood, she asked Claude why in the world he didn't come and get his cat under control.
"You told us to go out in the hall," Claude said, just as if he were the ordinary kind of first grader who did whatever teacher said to do.
Now, the cat settled down a little bit once it got something to eat. Most of the goldfish and Ramona Billion's two pet mice that she brought to show and tell. Ramona cried and carried on so, "I can't even bury them," she said, and they sent her home. Well, the room was a wreck. Broken glass and papers and books and puddles of water and dead goldfish everywhere. Miss Brandell sort of wrecked, too, and most of the first graders were hysterical. So somebody took them outdoors and let them have recess for the rest of the day. Claude took the cat home, and after that, there's a rule that you couldn't bring anything to show and tell. The Herdmans moved from grade to grade through Woodrow Wilson's school like a South American fish that stripped your bones clean in 3 minutes flat, which was just about what they did to one teacher after another. But they never, never got kept back a grade. When it came time for Claude Herdman to pass to the second grade, he didn't know his ABCs or his numbers or his colors or his shapes or his three bears or how to get along with anybody for that matter, but Miss Brandell passed him anyway. For one thing, she knew she'd have old Ollie Herdman the next year. That's the thing about those Herdmans. There was always another one coming along, so no teacher is crazy enough to let herself in for two of Herdmans at one time. I was always in the same grade with Imogene Herdman, and what I did was stay out of her way. It wasn't easy to stay out of her way. You couldn't do it if you're very pretty or very ugly or very smart or very dumb or had anything unusual about you, you know, like red hair or double-jointed thumbs. But if you were sort of a medium kid like me and kept your mouth shut when the teacher said, "Who can name all 50 states?" well, you had a pretty good chance that they'd clear Imogene. As far as anyone could tell, Imogene was just like the rest of the Herdmans. She never learned anything either except dirty words and secrets about everybody. Twice a year, we had to go to the health room to get weighed and measured, and Imogene always managed to find out exactly what everybody weighed. Sometimes she would hang around waiting for the nurse, Miss Hemphill, to give her a Band-Aid, and sometimes she'd sneak behind a curtain where they kept a folding cot and just stay there the whole time with one eye on the scales. "Oh, what are you still here, Imogene?" Miss Hemphill would ask one day. You can go back to your room." "I think you better look and see if I got what Ollie's got." "Well, what does Ollie have?" Imogene shrugged. "We don't know. Red spots all over." Miss Hemphill looked at her. "Well, what did the doctor say?" "We didn't have a doctor." Imogene began scrunching her back up and down against the medicine cabinet. Well, does Ollie have a fever? Is he in bed?" "No, he's in the first grade." "Right now?" Miss Hemphill stared. Why, he shouldn't be in school with red spots. It could be measles or chicken pox, any number of things, contagious things. What are you doing?" "Scratching my back," Imogene said. "Boy, do I itch." "The rest of you boys and girls go back to your classroom," Miss Hemphill said. "And Imogene, you stay right here." So we all went back to her room, and Miss Hemphill went to the first grade to look at Ollie, and Imogene stayed in the health room and copied down everybody's weight from Miss Hemphill's records. Your weight was supposed to be this big secret, like what you got on your report card. "It's nobody's business what you get on your report card," all the teachers used to say. And Miss Hemphill said the same thing. "It's nobody's business what you weigh. Not even the fat kids could find out what they weighed. But Imogene always knew." "Hey, don't let Albert Pelfrey on that swing," she'd yell at recess. "He'll bust it. Albert Pelfrey weighs 143 pounds. Last time he weighed 137. So right away, everybody knew two things about Albert. We knew exactly how fat he was, and we also knew that he's getting fatter all the time. "You have to go to fat camp this summer," Imogene hollered at him. "Miss Hemphill wrote it down on your paper." Fat camp is a place where they feed you lettuce and grapefruit and cottage cheese and eggs for a month, and you either give up and cheat or you give up and get skinny.
"I am not," Albert said. "I'm going to Disneyland with my Uncle Frank."
"That's what you think," Imogene told him. Albert had to believe her. She's always right about things like that. So all year he had fat camp to look forward to instead of Disneyland.
Sometimes Imogene would blackmail the fat kids. If they had anything she wanted, like Wanda Pierce's charm bracelet. Wanda Pierce weighed about a ton. She even had fat eyes. And her hobby was this little charm bracelet. It had 22 charms, and every single one of them did something. Little wheels turned, and a little bit of piano keys went plink, 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 or the little tiny drawers opened and closed. Besides being a fat kid, Wanda was also a rich kid. So every time you turned around, she had a new charm. "Look at my new charm," she'd say. "It costs $6.95 without the tax. It's a bird. And when you push his little knob, its wings just flutter, flutter, flutter. Cost $6.95. Well, they were great charms, but everybody got sick of hearing about them, so it was almost a relief when Imogene blackmailed her out of it. "I know how much you weigh, Wanda," Imogene told her. "See, I wrote it down on this piece of paper." Well, it must have been an awful amount, because even Wanda looked horrified. So Imogene got her charm bracelet. She got Lucille Golden's imitation alligator pocketbook souvenir of Florida written on it. For a while, she got 10 cents a week from Floyd Brush, till Floyd caught double pneumonia and lost 15 pounds and didn't care anymore. My friend Alice Wendelken was so nasty clean that she had detergent hands by the time she is 4 years old. Just the same, Alice picked up a case of head lice when she was at summer camp. And somehow Imogene found out about that. She'd sneak up on Alice at recess and holler, "Cooties!" and smack Alice's head. She nearly knocked Alice cross-eyed before one of the teachers saw her and took both of them to the principal. "Now, what's this all about?" Principal wanted to know, but Alice wouldn't say. "I had to hit her," Imogene told him. "She got cooties, and I saw one of them crawling out. I don't want them all over me." "You did not see one," Alice said. "I don't have them anymore." What do you mean you don't have them anymore?" the principal said. Did you have them lately?" It really shook him up. He didn't want a whole school full of kids with cooties, so he sent Alice to the health room, and the nurse went all through her head with a fine-tooth comb and a magnifying glass and finally said it's all right, but it's too late. Everybody called Alice cooties the whole rest of the year. If Imogene didn't know a secret about a person, she'd make one up. She'd catch you in the girl's room or out in the hall and whisper, "I know what you did." And then you'd go crazy trying to figure out what it was you did that Imogene knew about. It is no good trying to get secrets on the Herdmans. Everybody already knew about how awful things they did, and you couldn't even tease them about their parents or holler, "Hey, your father's in jail," because they didn't care. Actually, they didn't know what their father was or where he was or anything about him, because when Gladys was 2 years old, he climbed on a railroad train and disappeared, and nobody blamed him. Now and then, you'd see Miss Herdman walking the cat on a length of chain around the block, but she worked double shifts at the shoe factory and wasn't home much. So the Herdmans pretty much looked after themselves. Ralph looked after Imogene, Imogene looked after Leroy, and Leroy looked after Claude, and so on down the line. The Herdmans were like most big families. The big ones taught the little ones everything they knew, and the proof of that was the meanest Herdman of all, Gladys, the youngest. We figured they were headed straight for hell by the way of the state penitentiary until they got themselves mixed up with the church pageant and my mother in our Christmas pageant. Chapter 2. Now, before I go on to this, I will have to tell you that I'm going to read excerpts. It'd be impossible for me to get the whole thing down at one setting, so I'm just going to read excerpts from the story.
Mike, we're enjoying this greatly. The kids are over here giggling. I'm giggling more than they are. You've got, you're about halfway through. You've got, let's see, about 16 more minutes to give you an idea here.
Okay.
So, all right?
All right. Mother didn't expect to have anything to do with the Christmas pageant except to make me and my little brother Charlie be in it. We didn't want to. And to make my father go and see it. He didn't want to either. Every year he said the same thing. "I've seen the Christmas pageant." "You haven't seen it this year. This year's Christmas pageant," Mother'd tell him. "Charlie's a shepherd this year." "Charlie's a shepherd last year." "No, you just go on. I'm just going to put my bathrobe and sit by the fire and relax. There's never anything different about the Christmas pageant." "There's something different this year," Mother said. "Oh, yeah? What's that?" "Charlie's wearing your bathrobe." Well, the thing was, the Herdmans didn't know a thing about the Christmas story. And what happened is that, as a matter of fact, the Herdmans weren't even going to show up for the Christmas pageant until Charlie, the brother, let on that they got refreshments at church. And the Herdmans showed up. Not only did they not put any money in the collection plate, but they took quite a bit out. And they did some other things that shocked the entire congregation. But, of course, they sort of bullied their way in because they're great moviegoers. And they love plays and movies, and so they decided that they will be in it. So here we're about to begin the first thing about where they're going to enter the play.